Thank you very much, Darren. Good afternoon. Just in case you're walking on Fifth Avenue in New York, jogging around the Corniche in Abu Dhabi, late night dining in Shibuya in Tokyo, or just chilling out on Long Street in Cape Town, South Africa, let me tell you, this is Croke Park on the north side of Dublin City. It's September 4th, 2016. We are calling out to you from the seventh floor in what is lovingly known as the Hogan Stand. Proud Corkman Donal O'Cusick, three times an All-Ireland medalist and clear selector, is standing right beside me. To the left, the Nelly Stand on Hill 16 is full. No seats available across the way in the Cusick Stand. And to my right, every seat has been sold out for a week at the Davin End. There is no venue in the world right now that has over 82,000 people gathered in what is undoubtedly one of the greatest stadiums in the world. Can you hear their voices? Can you hear the Artane band march across the green field of GAA headquarters with 30 warriors behind them? Shane Prendergast from Cara leads the men from Kilkenny, black and amber jerseys clinging to their muscular bodies. To their immediate left are 15 Tipperary soldiers. Hurleys held firmly in their grasp, with Captain Brendan Maher from Barisalee leading them into yet another battle with Kilkenny. 2016 has already been a remarkable year on the international stage. The music world lost David Bowie and Prince. In sport, the greatest of all, Muhammad Ali, passed away, and he too graced this fabulous Croke Park Arena on July 19, 1972. The GAA lost the brilliant handballer Michael Duxie Walsh, and two former presidents, Jack Bootman from Wicklow and Joe McDonough, who sang The West Awake after his County Galway won the All-Ireland hurling title on this very day 36 years ago. Remember them all today, and the many volunteers in the GAA world who have passed away but have left a legacy of love and affection. While the world changes, some things in Ireland never change. Back here in Croke Park, the parade continues. It's Tipperary versus Kilkenny, but there is one change. Whoever wins this gets an All-Ireland medal with a special added inscription, 1916-2016, to celebrate the centenary of the Irish Rising. Listen to the noise, listen to the heartbeat of the people of Ireland. All-Ireland hurling final day shouldn't be, in my humble opinion, a national holiday. I've said it before, but I want to say it again. If you had to leave home because of unemployment, or you just wanted to see the world, don't feel left out, because you are with us today in spirit and in mind. We are thinking of you. We are Irish and we are family.
What I will say is, as a family, we're heartbroken, but we have no regrets where Dara is concerned. She lived her life to the full and she loved what she did. She wanted to be a mother. She adopted Fionn. She absolutely adores him, and they say it takes a village to raise a child, and he has a village around him now who will raise him on her behalf.
Was she always conscious, Niamh, that this was a dangerous job, or was that something she considered at all?
We actually talked not only to Dara but to the rest of the crew a lot about this, because, for instance, Ciarán Smith, I knew him, Paul Ormsby, we knew him. A lot of the crew in Waterford and Sligo, we know them, in the Dublin base as well. And different times we've talked to them about it, and what they always said to us is, we're trained.
You hated India. You hated India so much. You hated the idea of going there.
I never said that.
Yeah, no, I know you
didn't. Do you know that tourism to India from Ireland is way up this year?
I'm only saying it. I'm telling you because you're not allowed to say it. I could hear it in your voice, see it in your face. I watched the program. I could see it now. India and France equals never again. Correct equation.
Funny enough now, you're going to laugh because I probably will be going to India in October on a business thing, all
That's
right?
That's karma.
Yeah.
They know all about that.
But I'll be well organised this time. I'll have Kit Kats in the bag and a few more things like that, I can tell you.
How was your tummy?
I wasn't well in India. I was very sick. Honestly now.
What happened?
I just got a dose of the tummy and I had it for 5 days on a bus traveling 200 miles a day. Can you imagine?
No. Was it anything in particular or was it the whole gamut?
Oh, I don't know what I ate. Funny enough, I didn't eat anything because I wasn't eating. I just don't like that food. I'm sorry now, India. I don't mean to upset all those lovely people, but I just don't like the food. So I ate bananas and white rice. And I got on grand till I got a dose of the tummies.
Crimes did take place, but they were deemed not guilty by reason of insanity. That the people who did speak to me did so, Sean, on condition that we don't name them. And they're obviously at a stage in their treatment and in their recovery where they're stable enough to be able to talk about what they did and where they are now. Now, this first person I met him in his room. It's a small cell-like space in the old main 19th century building. He calls the incident the index crime. That's the phrase he uses to process what happened. This is some of his story.
I've just come into your room here. It's in the older part of the building here, isn't it? So you've got these lovely tall windows, a single bed. The rooms in the unit were done up a couple of days ago, and they did a spotless job. But we all like our rooms now. It made an awful difference. But it's perfect now. You could eat your, as they say, eat your dinner off the floor. Not a prison at all, more a hospital.
It is quite secure, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. It is very secure. And staff member leaves one door, they lock it behind them. When they go through, they lock all the doors behind them. So, don't you know, there'll be no chance of escaping or anything. I'm in 15 years now, which is a long time. I've done so much in that 15 years.
In terms of your recovery?
Recovery, mental health and that. Getting over my illness and that.
Do you want to talk a little bit around the circumstances that led you to being here?
Being here. My first time I had a nervous breakdown when I was 18. And over the last 30 years, I've been in and out of hospitals every couple of years. I did an awful thing. I was sick at the time. I realised that. And no, I got NGRI, not guilty by reason of sanity, in my court case. But it's only really now, in the last 6 months or a year, that I have changed. I might as well say it now, because I have to do an index crime course in the next few weeks. So that's dealing about the index crime. And the index crime I put up on was the killing of my father. And it took me 15 years to come along to be able to admit that I was sick. I didn't forgive myself beforehand, but now in the last 6 months, I realised that I was sick.
I could see just now as you were kind of building up to say that.
So I can stand up and say, well, actually, I did that. I'm not proud of it in that. I realised that I was sick at the time and it was my fault.
Took you a long time to realise that?
Oh, it took me, yeah. My father, yeah.
Do you think about him?
Oh, I do. Oh, yeah. Every day I think about him, all right. Because himself, he had a shop. And when I did my leave cert, I went into working for him in that for a few years. So I was very close to him. Between the family, I was the closest person to him, dad and myself. Actually, a few weeks before the index crime, himself and myself went down to the Killarney for a weekend. And just the two of us spent the weekend down there and that. He footed the bill because most of the time I didn't have much money.
There will be a day where you won't be in here, probably.
Please God, yeah, please God. Well, St. Edith's, there's a new hospital being built in St. Edith's, and that'll be done in the next couple of years. So my doctor, Dr. Mom, said I'll be transferred to the day in a couple of years' time.
You talked about your mum when I came in initially. You're close to your mum.
Oh, yeah. She's been my cornerstone. Unconditional love.
That really is unconditional love.
Yeah.
That was Come With Me Now, performed by Congos, a pretty cool South African band of brothers. Really like that track. Welcome to Late Date. I'm your host tonight, sitting in the presenter's chair. Leo Varadkar is my name. And I'm going to be with you for the next 2 hours. So you're going to hear lots of music, some news, a lot of Irish talent, a few requests, absolutely no politics, and I hope you enjoy it. Next up is Sweet Disposition by Temper Trap.
And when we got to the obstacle, we were 2 strides away from the hurdle. And just in that moment of mistrust in the communication that my horse had with me, this trust shattered like a thin sheet of glass. It broke down, and he took off a stride too soon. And in the hyperextension of his body, his pelvis broke. So when he crashed through the hurdle, his head flung back just at that moment when I was being propelled forward with the momentum of the stride. And his head collided with my head and knocked me unconscious before I hit the ground. So when I hit the ground, I was laying there prone on the ground, and the horse was laying stricken on the other side of me. And Charlie Swan was coming from behind on his horse, and he's done everything to avoid hitting me. And the horse, instinct screamed within the horse that he was riding to avoid the bigger of the two obstacles. And he chose to try to jump me and failed to make it and landed on my head.
Landed
with his hoof,
head.
Shattering my skull in 12 places and leaving me with 2 blood clots and the brain.
And your parents knew this was very, very serious. Everybody there knew.
Everybody knew because the winning horse had passed the winning post, and Peter O'Sullivan, the commentator, was still making reference to the fact that I hadn't moved on the ground.
While she was talking to me and I was feeling so happy, I looked down and I noticed that her tummy was sticking out. And I just got this awful sense of dread. And I don't know why I did, because I couldn't have put a name on it. And then I forgot about it. And that very night we were at home in our house and we were in the sitting room, probably watching television. And the next thing we could hear raised voices coming from the kitchen. And that was very unusual, as you can imagine, in a household of all females. And then we heard the front door slamming and then there was this awful silence. And I, looking back, I think I did know in my heart what had happened, although I still wouldn't have been able to put it into words at that stage.
Right.
And very soon after that, Adrian and the baby, Gina, and I went back to boarding school. And my mother used to come and visit us every Sunday religiously, and she would sit in the car in school and we would talk for hours in the car, and then she would drive to the village and we would get tuck for the week.
Right.
And then she stopped coming for many, many Sundays, and we didn't know why. But my godmother, who lived nearby, my Auntie Kay, she came instead. And it was only afterwards then I found out why my mother wasn't there.
Which was?
Which was that Bernice had gone to England to wait out her pregnancy, and my mother had gone over to spend some time with her.
And your mother never told you?
No.
Bernice never told you?
No.
Nothing?
No.
We have to step up. This is all hands on deck. You know, I've been reading through reports from IBEC and reports from economists. And what they're all saying is that the combination of Brexit and of what's happening in Europe and of what's happening in the US poses arguably the most serious economic threat we in Ireland have faced in decades.
And what has that got to do, Stephen Donnelly, with you today joining a party that you described just 3 years ago as a party with a culture of jobs for the boys, bonuses for the boys, lack of accountability, and two fingers to the dole?
I don't know where you're quoting that from.
I'm quoting it from the Sunday Independent. You wrote it in January 2014.
But that's certainly not my language. I stand to be corrected, but that's
you didn't
not
write it.
I don't believe I wrote those words. I stand to be corrected.
We'll certainly double check it, but
I will. But it doesn't sound like the kind of language I use. But your question is a fair question. What has changed?
Sorry, Stephen Donnelly, I'm told they're on your own website as well.
Okay. Well, then, fair enough.
Okay. So address the content. 2014, the culture associated with Fianna Fáil: jobs for the boys, houses for the boys, lack of accountability, and two fingers to the dole. And this is the party you've now joined today.
Mary, we have been overtaken by events. We are looking at Brexit. We're looking at the US administration under Trump. We're looking at the rise of extremism.
The crossbar side, is Ireland put the squeeze on here now? And it's England who look to try and rescue the grand slam at the death here. Sinclair has it. Sinclair smashed onto the ground. Back there with George Ford, who's absolutely devoured by the Irish forwards. It's back with Danny Kerr. Danny Kerr has control of it. Robbie Henshaw there at Sinclair grapples at him. And it's England who still have maintained advantage on this near side. They have numbers out. It's knocked on by Mike Brown, the vice-captain, on the near side of the pitch. The referee has blown the whistle. Mike Brown has knocked it on, and he looks up to the sky, and he's the fella who's dropped the hot potato at the Aviva Stadium. It is Ireland with a just simply, truly majestic performance. What an afternoon.
Absolutely fantastic. What a display. What heart shown by Ireland at the end.
It's back home, a story on the front page of all our newspapers today and has been for the last couple of days. The discovery of a significant quantity of human remains at the site of the former mother and baby home in Tuam in County Galway. The dig, which led to the discovery, came about after research unearthed by local historian Catherine Corliss, who in a column for the History Show has been reflecting on why she was drawn to the story and the historian's tools that she used to uncover it.
I had always been curious about the Tuam Mother and Baby Home. I remembered the little children who had been in the same class as me in the Mercy Convent National School in Tuam, albeit their stay being so brief. The home babies, as they were known, were only kept in the home until they made the First Communion, and then they were fostered out to families in either counties Galway or Mayo, depending on where the mother originated from, as the Tuam home catered for all of County Galway and Mayo as well. My vague memory of the home babies was that they were miserable-looking children who were kept segregated from the rest of the class, who came to school 10 minutes later than we did and who left 10 minutes earlier in the evening. And this had ensured that no friendships would develop between them and us so-called respectable people. My first search for records or for any information on the Tuam home was to visit the local library, but much to my surprise, there was literally nothing to be found there, except for a mention of the home in a thesis written by a local academic, where there was a few details of the plight of the unmarried mother and her subsequent banishment to the home. I had hoped to find some references to the home in the microfilm archive of the local Tuam Herald newspaper. But yet again, the references to Tuam home were sparse, except for some advertisements for tenders from the county home, which included the mother and baby home, for coffins. After querying some of the older residents who lived close to the surrounding high walls of the Tuam home, I gathered some scraps of information which, when compiled, told a tale of sadness and injustice. Very few people were actually employed in the home, and those who made deliveries were met at the gate. The mothers who gave birth in the home did most of the work there inside and out, and the resident gardener, Dog's Body, was a woman called Julia, who had been in the home since its beginning. I gained a lot of knowledge of what went on inside those high walls from some tape recordings which were done on the life story of this very same Julia, and from which tapes I transcribed every word that she uttered, and her words portrayed a very harsh regime for both mothers and children and babies, and the women who were kept on in the home as domestics. Then came the question of the deaths of mothers and babies in the home and where they could be buried. I had no success at all with inquiries to the headquarters of the Bonsecours Sisters in Cork, Galway County Council, or the Western Health Board, which is now the HSE West, or indeed the local clergy. I continued my quest for information and tried the Births, Deaths, Marriages Registration Office in Galway, who very kindly searched their registers and came back to me with a startling revelation that yes, they had death certs for the Tuam home, all 798 of them. And did I want to purchase them? Yes, I sure did.
And I believe you have to spend time on the red carpet on the night. Is there a requirement for everyone on the team to have a Hollywood look?
No, actually, there's just two of us who actually spend time on the red carpet on Sunday. Myself and my colleague, Martha Ruiz. We're the two partners responsible for overseeing all of the work. We are the only two who know the results, the winners, prior to the show and prior to the envelopes being opened on stage. So We do the final tabulations ourselves, so nobody even on that big team that I mentioned really know who won, except Martha and myself. We then select the winning cards and insert those into the envelopes. There are 24 categories, 24 winners, essentially. We then, you know, take those in our briefcase to the red carpet on Sunday, and throughout the entire show, stand backstage handing the envelopes to the presenters just before they walk on stage to announce the winner.
Because of her love for you, she wanted to protect you, and knowing that you had been questioned by the Gardaí, she sent you, or told you and your husband Barry, to be out of Dublin.
Yes.
When she was doing it.
Kilkenny. She sent us to Kilkenny.
Right.
Yeah.
It's sort of funny enough, isn't it? That and then you walked around Kilkenny making sure that you're on CCTV.
It was very surreal. And again, in fairness, Barry was, if it was me, I'd have just stayed in the hotel and cried all night long and had no proof of where I was. But Barry was the one who said, practicality has to kick in here and we need to be seen on camera in a couple of places to prove that we hadn't driven back to Dublin, because if I was in control I probably would have driven back to Dublin because she needed us, but that's not what happened and we stayed in Kilkenny.
And before you left her on your last meeting, That must have been...
Yeah, it was difficult.
Yeah.
Very. Very difficult.
But it was lovely as well, your description of it, and you told each other what you...
Yeah, we both sobbed. Sat in front of each other and held hands and cried a lot and talked a lot, but I wasn't going to get the opportunity to say anything again. Nor was she, so I suppose you're... And we both spoke quite easily about the love we had for each other. Sure, so conversation was never stunted with us. Conversation flowed, so it wasn't a hard thing to get out, but it was a hard thing to get out. Yeah, it was. But I didn't leave with anything unsaid, which I'm happy with.
I'd now like to warmly welcome all of those European countries joining us. And we say good morning to listeners in Norway, the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, Finland, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Germany, Slovenia, Belgium, Spain, and Switzerland. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the early morning sound of birdsong.
Well, he went away for a weekend to Sligo with some of his friends. One of his friends was a student in Sligo, and they went up for the weekend to have a bit of a do. And they were walking home from a nightclub late that Saturday night, and they were attacked because of their unusual accents, because we're from North Tipperary. And in those days, people didn't travel that much to different counties. So they were attacked, unprovoked, and he was stabbed in the back by the perpetrator. In the back now, not the front, in the back.
And was the perpetrator...
That speaks multitudes for itself, you know, in the back.
Yeah. And was the perpetrator caught?
He was, and he was sentenced to 6 years imprisonment for manslaughter. Now, I won't keep you long. Okay. 6 years for manslaughter. Those times the courts were... I don't know if you remember Rumpold of the Bailey.
Of course, yeah.
Nobody could understand what anybody was saying, and... it came out that he was carrying the knife, presumably for hunting, for fishing and panting rabbits of a Saturday night. And, of course, our peers, the jury, believed. So there's nothing we can do with the sentencing.
Well, this man was called Richard Kelly.
Richard Kelly, yes, in Sligo. I think he was 18 at the time. I don't want to give him much air because of what he's done. He's never come to our family to apologise or explain his actions. And it took 30 years, so I presume he doesn't care. He's quite happy. He served his sentence and, as he thinks, has paid his dues to society.
You were the man who wielded the knife that killed John Fox 30 years ago, March the 1st.
Sadly, Joe, yes, indeed.
And why do you want to talk today?
Well, Joe, if I could read out a small little piece off the email that I sent in to you, if I could.
Yeah.
Okay, so the small bit of the email is, if I could turn back time, if I could have John Fox back with his family again, I would make it happen in a heartbeat. It is a terrible thing to realise, to know you ended someone's life. Humans are supposed to be makers of life, givers of life, not takers of life. And I do fully understand and accept that taking a life is a crime against man and nature.
And just to tell listeners, we have Angus McNally, our producer, has been talking to the Fox family and has alerted them to the fact that you had contacted us and wished to say and warn people about the lifelong impact of such a lunatic and tragic behaviour. And we've obviously told the Fox family in the belief that maybe they would not want to listen, or they want to listen maybe in their own time.
I don't have All-Ireland medals for football like the rest of the people in our county, but I do actually have 3 All-Ireland medals for whistling, because many years ago, my mother used to take me on the Flakehole circuit, and in my case, it used to be you'd have to win a South Kerry, you'd have to win a Kerry, you'd have to win a Munster, and then you'd be on for your All-Ireland. And I did that 3 years in a row, and I was fortunate enough to win my 3 All-Ireland medals. And when I wasn't able to get them in Croke Park, I got them on the Flakehole circuit. But what actually happened, when I was going for the 4th in a row, you couldn't make it up. The great Dennis P.O. Sullivan organised a sports day every year in the parish of Kilgarvan. And one of the sports that would be held in the field was a greasy pole. Now, you know what that was. You'd be up on a greasy pole, you would have a pillow, and you would have a pillow fight with somebody else. But didn't I get a belt in the back of the head and down with my head and bounced it off the greasy pole and broke my front tooth? This was in the era, Marty, that if a person broke their front tooth, there was no notice in the world taken of it, and you were left that way. You were like damaged goods. There was no such thing as after the orthodontist or anything like that. So I was left with my broken tooth, and when it came to the South Kerry flare, I realised I was not material because I was no longer able to whistle.
At night, Katie has up to 10 violent seizures. She agreed to record herself for one night.
It's 1:37 and I'm going to try to get some sleep.
Barely an hour into sleep, Katie is already experiencing her second seizure. The seizures continue until early morning.
I say we might as well get another bottle. Can't we sleep it off on the morning flight? Welcome back. A texter says, aren't these footballers very lucky? Only a few hours a week, hundreds of thousands of euro. Well, nice work if you can get it. Now, this being our Saturday show, slightly less important, it's competition lyric time from Beyoncé.
Beyoncé.
What is it?
Beyoncé.
Beyoncé. Got me hoping you'll save me right now. Looking so crazy in love's got me looking so crazy in love. Uh-oh, no. And so on and so forth. That's to win a two-night stay in a Nama hotel just an hour off the M. Something or other, not for me. I'll be drinking Cab Sauv from a box in Provence. Don't knock the box till you've tried it, or so I'm told.
The Beatles wrote a song about your brother when he died. Why did they do that? Did they know him?
I think they did know him just, but he was really a friend of the Rolling Stones more than the Beatles. But I think it was just because they picked up a newspaper cutting and that prompted the song.
Yeah.
Because something that, if I could add to that, I was in Tara's flat in London one evening, and a bit of a party going on with Peter Sellers and all sorts of things, Mick Jagger and friends, but they were playing the Chieftains One. That's the Garrards. That was the first Chieftains that we made, and fascinated they were. Sorry, just a little sideline there, Garrard. Sorry.
No, it's really interesting. Let's listen now to that beautiful song the Beatles wrote about your brother, Garrard.
That's good.
Thank you.
saw the